Hello there, and welcome to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio and this episode of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, the podcast dedicated to the great volunteer fire service and getting the message out that true professionalism is not defined by any paycheck, and developing and displaying and maintaining a professional image and reputation are the duty and responsibility of all firefighters. Tom Merrill here. So glad to have you joining in. As always, I'd like to thank Chief Bobby Halton and Fire Engineering for the opportunity to bring you my podcast, as well as all the other great podcasts that they sponsor that talk about topics of importance and relevance in our fire service. I can't believe it's already September. I mean, in my area, especially where we don't get a lot of summer, it has just been a spectacular summer, and I don't want it to end. I can't believe that fall is around the corner. As a matter of fact, just last week, or be 2 weeks ago now, we moved my daughter back into college down at the beautiful St. Bonaventure University in Allegheny, New York. I just cannot believe that we're into that routine already. And, you know, it's not too early to begin talking about FDIC 2023 and maybe to start making your plans to go there between April 24th and 29th next year in Indianapolis. So get it on your calendar. And remember, it's one of the greatest firefighting conferences in the entire world. They picked their instructors a couple weeks ago, and I'm excited, as always, so honored to again be invited back. I'll be doing an hour and 45-minute class at FDIC next year, and I hope to see you there and hope to see you out and about. And I'm really honored to be picked again. They have so many people putting in to present there, and it means so much to me to get picked again to go back for, I think it's my 9th time, might have been my 10th if COVID didn't interrupt everything. But it's just an absolute honor to be there. And if you've never been, please, if you can make plans to do so, I would highly encourage it. And if you've been, then what's that old expression? If you know, you know. So again, FDIC 2023, April 24th to 29th next year. Hope to see you in Indy. And I got to tell you, I'm blown away with the amount of travel I've been doing this year, getting the message out about the professional volunteer. And I've got a lot of new classes I've put together, professional development for the volunteer firefighter. Of course, I have my leadership classes, officer development classes. I've got a customer service class, lessons in our history, just a ton of classes. I've been out and about, and it's not going to stop anytime soon. Where am I headed off to? A couple of weeks, next week, I'll be down in Bowbridge, Louisiana. In October, I'm headed off to Tennessee, and I'll be going to the VCOS conference in Clearwater, Florida in November, doing a presentation there. So, gosh, I hope I can see some of you great firefighters at some of these conferences. If you're going to be in the area, please stop in, check out the class or the conference in the case of VCOS, and reach out to me if anyone would like to talk to me about bringing any of my presentations out your way. I really, really enjoy getting out. And you've heard me say it before. Every time I come home and my wife says, "How was it?" I tell her I made 100 or 200 new friends, because the fire service is amazing. It is filled with incredible people, just absolutely the most friendly, down-to-earth people that anyone would ever want to be involved with. And I'm speaking to the choir, aren't I? I know you know that. So, I'm just blessed to be part of it and really enjoying myself as I go out about the country. So also, speaking of one other thing about FDIC, I'm hoping, and we're hoping, Penwell is hoping, that my book, The Professional Volunteer Fire Department, will be released at FDIC 2023. That's the target date. Everything's been submitted to the publisher. Photos. We're working on final edits now, so stay tuned for more information on that. I'd be honored if you get a chance to get the book come sometime next year. I'll have lots more information on that. It's something that has consumed me for the last 2.5-3 years. Put a lot of work and effort into it, just putting chapters together, talking about what it means to be a professional volunteer firefighter, and how to run a professional volunteer fire department and try and portray the image of professionalism in your agency based on things that I've learned. That's not all my beliefs. It's things people have told me that have worked for them. And I just want to share it. And I'm so grateful for that opportunity. So stay tuned for more information on that. So on this episode of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, we have a return guest with us. Back by popular demand, you can say, Fire Chief Richard Ray, who has 30 years in the fire service. He's a battalion chief down in Durham, North Carolina. I say down because I'm up north, so it could be up for you from wherever you're listening in. But he's a battalion chief in the Durham Fire Department, and he's also has a lot of volunteer experience. He's got quite a background on the volunteer side. He's a captain in the Creedmoor Volunteer Fire Department in his hometown. And the chief instructs on a national level, such as FDIC, where I first came to know him several years ago. Again, folks, you hear me talk about the importance of getting out to the conferences. Doesn't always have to be the big national FDIC or large conferences. Could be the local ones in your area, but get out there and network and meet these great firefighters, because you'll gain friends for life. So get out there, as Jocko, my favorite Navy SEAL, always says, get after it. But I'm pleased to welcome him back. He was last on the Professional Volunteer Fire Department podcast about 3 years ago, when he shared a lot of very important and very helpful, actually, information about winning on the fire ground, which is a title of a very popular presentation he does. In that class, he presents many great ideas on things that can be done in your hometown volunteer fire department to make yourself and your firefighters better prepared to operate at fires and on emergency scenes. And I sat in on that at FDIC, and I certainly all encourage anybody listening, if you ever get a chance to see Chief Ray speak, please take the opportunity to do so. You'll walk away a better educated firefighter and spend a few minutes with the chief. You'll have a friend for life like I do. So like I said, he was with us a few years ago, and he spent a great couple of hours talking to us on winning on the fire ground. And so I'd run into him every now and then at FDIC, and I always enjoy our conversation. And I'll tell you, if I'm ever to pick up one of the fire magazines and see that he contributed and put an article in there, I made sure I would read it, because he always has good things to say. He knows what he's talking about. He doesn't just walk or talk the talk. He certainly walks the walk, and he hits home when he talks about the volunteer issues, because he certainly knows a lot about the volunteer fire service. So Chief, I want to welcome you to the show. It's so great to have you back on with me.
Well, Chief, thank you for having me. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Humbled to be on the show with you. Look forward to talking and shop, and it's good to be back on the podcast. Thank you.
Well, and I know I appreciate you taking the time, because I know you got a busy day. The vice president's coming into town, I think you told me. And so if the phone rings or the pager goes off, I certainly understand that we hit the pause button and continue at another time. So for the purpose of our listeners, for just helping them out a bit, I know a lot of people know who you are, but if someone's hearing Chief Ray for the first time, how about just a little bit of background on who you are and what brought you into the fire service and what you're doing?
Sure. So my fire service career, I guess you could say, kind of, I started kind of when I was a kid. My grandfather was fire chief of the Creedmoor Volunteer Fire Department. And then my dad was on. And so I kind of grew up around it. Growing up, I love being around the fire department, being around the guys, being around the service. And, you know, when I turned 18, I joined, but I really didn't have an idea that it's something that I would pursue as a profession, as a career. So, went to college, would come home about every weekend from college just so I could do fire department related things. And, my dad became chief of the volunteer fire department. And so, about halfway through college, I said, you know, this is a career path that I want to pursue. This is my passion. This is what I love to do. And after I graduated college, I was fortunate enough to be hired with the city of Durham. So as my career has taken me on the volunteer side, you know, I've been the training officer in Creedmoor, and been a line officer there for for a number of years now. I've got about 30, this year marks my 30th year with the Creedmoor Volunteer Fire Department. And I guess one of the things that I'd really like to add here, Chief, is that this year also marks the 80th year that my family has served with the Creedmoor Fire Department. And I'm pretty humbled by that and pretty proud of that aspect. And I have a my son and I have a nephew that's also, they've joined the junior ranks now. And I'm the advisor of the junior firefighter program there in Creedmoor. And you talk about love for the job. When you get around young kids that are sponges and trying to absorb as much as they can about the fire service, and you see them excited about it, it reignites the fire in you, if you will. So yeah. Pretty proud of that aspect. As far as the city of Durham goes, started here as a firefighter, I've come up through the ranks, spent some time in the training division as training officers, as a training officer, quite a bit of time with the academies, fortunate enough to make it to the rank of battalion chief, where I serve in the 4th Battalion, which is the east side of the city, on A shift. So, you know, I say all that to say that I'm just, it's a privilege and an honor to be a part of the fire service and to be able to serve, especially in both capacities on the volunteer and career side. I kind of get the best of both worlds, and you know, I just have a tremendous amount of respect for those on both sides of the coin, because we face a lot of the same challenges.
And, well, you certainly be commended for your service and everything you've done and continue to make an impact. And what that is, I just love that 80 years of family legacy and growing and continuing. I was going to ask if anyone was following up behind you, but to have a son and a nephew, and you're so right with what you say about those juniors too. I just was able to deliver some remarks on Saturday, this past Saturday. A local town near me had a junior firefighter day where they spent the entire day with them, putting them through different training evolutions on the fire on a nice training ground at one of the firehouses, and they had me come in to kickstart it with an hour welcome to the juniors, and I had a chance to meet about 24, 25 young men and women who are going to be entering the fire service or have entered the fire service as juniors. And you're right, you hook them young and you know, start that legacy early, and hopefully you keep them. And even if they don't stay local because jobs take them elsewhere, maybe that sure. volunteer hook is still there. And who knows, maybe like you, some of them will end up in the paid ranks. Heck, got me my paid job in the fire alarm office. So you never know what it's going to lead to. That's right. Awesome. That's fantastic. So sure enough, as I was saying to the listeners, I was reading through a recent Fire Engineering magazine, and there's an article by you. So I said, oh, this is mandatory reading. Cause like I said, when I see an article by you, I always make sure I read it. Matter of fact, I think I texted you. I was down at the National Volunteer Fire Council Training Summit in Orlando. And that afternoon I was sitting by the pool catching up on fire engineering. And I think that's when I read it and texted you and said, this would be a great podcast. And of course I'm talking about the recent article you did, 4 Key Elements of the Fire Ground. And I found right away that it was pertinent because it applied, in my opinion, to firefighters everywhere, paid, volunteer, paid on call, big department, small department, it need not matter. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, people listening, but one common denominator shared by everybody in this profession of ours is the word fire, right? And pretty much every fire department, the word fire is in the name. I think pretty much every fire department out there has a vehicle parked in the apparatus bay that has water on it or some other way designed to put water on a fire. So definitely a topic of importance that applies to everybody listening, whether you're paid on call, small, large, doesn't matter. It applies to all of us. And Chief, you talk about fire ground success. And right off the bat, you say it's measured differently from organizations, from organization to organization. But no matter how you judge it, there's some aspects we can control, and there's some aspects that we can't control. And I would agree with that. That's certainly true. And then you delve into the NIOSH 5 and tell the reader that by understanding these NIOSH 5 and what they are and what they mean, we might be able to find some answers that can help us achieve better fireground success to help keep our firefighters safer on the fireground. Can you discuss that relationship between the NIOSH 5 and how understanding that can play into your four key elements on the fire ground for achieving success?
I'd be glad to. So when you look at the NIOSH 5 and what they are, and one of the things that I think people should understand is that these are independent from, a lot of the other deaths, fatalities that we have within the service. These are pertinent to the fire ground. And so when I look at these five, I think about the fire ground that we're going, what's going on the fire ground, what's happening. And when the NIOSH 5 are the inadequate risk assessment, poor communications, inadequate command, lack of accountability, and lack of SOGs, or the failure to follow them, you start, it got me to thinking, well, what can we do to lessen the effects of these five things? What changes can we make within our organization? What changes as an individual can I make that can help prevent these one of the fallen victim to one of these five? And so when I was putting the article together, again, size up, command and control, resources, fire ground coordinations, all that kept coming back to mind for me. And in those four, I think you find a lot of things that fall into those NIOSH five. So for example, we'll start with fire ground coordination. That there goes back to, we can use our SOGs there to help coordinate our fire ground. It identifies our resources. It identifies, which resources is another one of those elements that I talked about. When you start putting those things together, now we start to lessen the effect of that failure to follow SOGs. So when you start coordinating, you use your SOGs. It gives you that platform to build from, and it allows you to lay that fire ground out. And I think one of the key elements that some people miss is that when we're talking about SOGs and how they relate to the fire ground, it gives us a good platform to build the fire ground from, and it puts everybody on the same page. And so depending on how your agency operates, a lot of times the chiefs, they're a ways out. They're delayed getting there. But if the personnel following SOGs, resources are like they should be, when they step onto the scene, things seem to transition a whole lot better. It's easier for them to pick up the ball and run with it and that kind of stuff. So that was kind of the thought process when I started looking in that aspect. Well, when you look at risk assessment as one of the top five, that falls back into those resources and that coordination, and again, we talk about risk assessment. Well, where does that begin? Well, that begins with size up. And I know I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit, but I think it's important to understand that, operational guidelines, we lay those out before we ever get the call. Okay. Then we talk about risk assessment. Well, that begins with size up. And the thing about size up is that it's in a lot of my classes, you ask people, well, when does size up begin for you? And what's interesting is that conversation can go down many different roads. And what I find interesting is that for a lot of different people, the size up piece starts at different elements. Everybody, by and large, firefighters will stay at the receipt of the call. And I would agree with that. But there's so much more going on when you talk about size up, and this kind of plays into that risk assessment piece. When they give you an address, that address point that you're going to a building fire, most firefighters in their mind are already thinking about the building that they're going to. They're thinking about road conditions. They're thinking about water supply. They're thinking about a lot of different elements that apply to that good solid size up. And they're doing that without even thinking, And when I say that, it's intuitive that, all right, I know that I'm going to this block of Main Street, and I know these are the buildings that are there. These are my occupancies. These are my hazards. And that's where the ball gets to really going. But it also can start too the day of. Like this morning, I come to work. I know that here in North Carolina today, it's a gorgeous day. It's mid-80s. The humidity is not nearly as bad as it has been in the last couple of days. And so I have to start thinking about how does the weather affect my fire ground? How does it affect my firefighters? So I start processing actually when I come to work. And that's part of that size up piece too. And conversely, on the volunteer side, we know that we're in my agency, in my organization, depending on the day of the week, the time of the call, you know, my size up process begins because I have to think about who's around, what are the buildings that we're going to. So it's a lot that kind of ties in together. And I mean, it's really dovetail in itself in that when we start going down the list, how do we put it together? That's kind of where it began for me. And then, of course, as a battalion chief now and somebody that's got just a couple years on the job.
No judging. There's no judging.
You know, I learned something that, you know, every day is a learning day, but command and control is a big piece. Especially on, I see that a lot on the volunteer side from my area. And the challenge there is that, and Chief, you can probably speak to this too. I'm not sure how it is from your area, but a lot of times that incident commander is also the pump operator. Or that incident commander is doing something other than focusing on the building. And what happens is that that's when we start getting in trouble with our firefighters. And if the incident commander is not communicating, that's even more problemsome, more troublesome for us. And I'll give you an example. There was a fire recently in my area a few months ago where the incident commander gets there. He's the pump operator. He's doing the best job that he can. But when you go back and play the radio traffic, you can hear where he's missed some very important messages and radio transmissions from crews operating on the interior. And he was more focused on water supply. And I'm not taking anything away from water supply because that was important for that fire. But I think I think it was in Houston where there was a firefighter that called a mayday and the incident commander was working on water supply and missed the mayday. And that particular incident kept coming through my mind when I was listening to the radio traffic from this call is that, you know, if I'm going to be in command and control of my firefighters, one, I've got to be watching the building, and two, I've got to be listening to that radio. And that's where that communication piece comes in.
You know, Chief, you outlined there is very common in a lot of the volunteer in a lot of our volunteer worlds, right? Especially during the day. You know, you might have an officer, chief, or maybe not even a chief. Maybe it's only a senior firefighter, but somebody taking charge. But they drove the truck, or there's some other way preoccupied that, you know, they're not the big city department where they have a chief standing out front. They're doing something else. I don't know how to fix that other than training yourself to be able to multitask so you can catch that important radio traffic or be observing what's going on, even though your back is to the building because you're at the pump panel. That's a tough thing, but it's reality in a lot of volunteer departments.
Well, you know, we talk about the volunteer side. Yeah, that's the dark reality of the volunteer service for a lot of places, in that it's not just necessarily with command, but also think about when you're trying, you know, the as demanding as the fire ground is, there's a reason why it takes firefighters on the fire ground, a number of them, to get things done, because there's a lot of things that have to be done at once, whether it's fire attack, search, ventilation, rapid intervention. I mean, the list goes on. And, you know, I can speak from my volunteer fire department, there are times where coordination, we don't have it just because we don't have the people there. We're waiting for mutual aid people to get there so that we can maybe do some sequential fire ground actions to get things done. And when you get to that command and control piece, because, hey, somebody's got to run the truck, we've got to get water flowing on the fire, but we got to have somebody in command. that's a tough dynamic to learn. I mean, and that's why in all the command training, it's like, hey, you've got to be focused on the building, focused on the fire. What's, you know, how do they say it? Eyes on fire, ears on radio, so to speak.
Right. Yeah.
And so that is tough. And you know, Chief, you say it right. I'm not real sure how do we overcome it. And I don't know that we can, other than when, you know, you have to start, you have to be somewhat of a forward thinker, I think, in that, hey, if I'm the incident commander of this call, but I've got to run the truck, I'm going to run the truck until I can get somebody here that can take it over so that I can be focused on the fire, because you owe that to your firefighters, especially if you're a chief or, you know, or line officer. You owe it to your firefighters to be paying attention to that building, because there's a lot of things that can go wrong.
And people can help too. I mean, let's face it, there's plenty of radios on the fire ground or at the emergency scene, a lot of other ears listening. So
that's right.
if
that's
an
right.
incident commander that's misses it, and of course, being a dispatcher, I'd be remiss if I didn't say the dispatcher plays a huge role there too. You know, they're sitting in maybe a little more, can be a very chaotic environment in the dispatch center, but once the operation's underway, it can be, you know, a little calmer than at the fire scene. So, you know, I always tell the dispatchers, your job's not done when, you know, you should be listening to every radio track, all the radio traffic. And if you catch an important transmission that incident commander missed, be sure to pass it on. It's almost like, you know, the terrorist warning, right? If you see something or hear something, say something. And that
That's
applies
correct.
To everybody on the fire ground.
100%. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, so this, when you started off here, we talked about those NIOSH 5, which again, for the purposes of just reviewing it for our listeners, we have inadequate, and NIOSH has identified 5 key contributors to firefighter fatalities: inadequate risk assessment, poor communications, inadequate command, lack of accountability, and lack of standard operating guidelines, SOGs, whatever you want to call them in your area. I like to say, put a good playbook together. But in those NIOSH 5, you identify 4 key elements that can help reduce these risks. Your 4 key elements, we hit on a couple of them: size up, command and control, resources, and fire ground coordination. And you mentioned size up just a few minutes ago, and I'd like to go back to that, because when I think of size up, I think back to when I was a young officer or even a young firefighter, and you're given that 13-point acronym, you know, COAL is wealth, or any of the other ones out there, and it can right away paint a bad picture of what size up truly is. And you nailed it so well when you said size up begins not when the call comes in, but before that. You know, what's the weather? What kind of day? Do you know a lot of your firefighters on the volunteer side are at work today? Or maybe how about this one? You know, you have a good young group of firefighters that are always around and helping out, but it's a Saturday and they're all going to a concert or something, so you're going to be short staffed. That all is also size up. The new building being built down the street or renovations going on. There's so much that goes into size up that gets missed because we're not paying attention or thinking ahead. And I think that's important to really harp on. And I think you have it so right that, you know, again, the NIOSH 5 major contributors to firefighter deaths. Well, let's get our size up in order and understand what it truly is to help maybe mitigate the risk when those tones drop. And I think it's just an important point. And you had some other helpful hints about how to conduct a proper size up, you know, and you even mentioned it's not just limited to the outside, is it? Can you delve into that a little bit more?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, when we talk about sizing a scene up assessment, everybody seems to just want to think about what they see from the exterior. And that, like we've said, that's extremely important. But it's also important when you crack that door and you're getting ready to make entry to conduct that search or do a fire attack, it's important to know what's going on inside, because sometimes conditions don't what you see from the outside is not always what's true to what's going on the inside. So I think it's an important aspect that, you know, hey, when you're getting ready to make entry into the building, you open that door, take you a second, maybe 2 or 3 seconds, get a look at what you're dealing with, because we talk about risk assessment and size up. Sometimes if you miss some key indications that, you know, from some fire behavior, that things might be going on inside that might be leading you to one of those serious events that we don't want to get caught in. And so I think it's important to understand that. And that goes even further when you start talking about search and understanding, okay, where's the fire located inside? What kind of a fire do I have inside? That whole interior piece, where are you going to search? Upstairs, downstairs, where are my exposures? All that's part of that interior size up. And again, we think about those things, we process those things, and we really target them. But a lot of times we don't put it in the mindset of, okay, I've got to size this up. I mean, a lot of the fire attacks that you hear, they'll say, water on the fire, right? Well, that's changing that size up because conditions are changing on the inside. And we know that size up is ongoing. Size up goes all the way through the incident. And whether you get water on the fire, getting your searches done, got some ventilation going, conditions are changing, and you constantly have to evaluate those interior conditions because, again, who are we trying to make it better for? And so that's, to me, that whole interior piece that a lot of times I think sometimes not because it's intentional, but just sometimes I don't think it's given enough weight on the fire ground as
Right.
maybe it should, you
You talk
know?
to some firefighters and they're like, well, I know the buildings in my area. I know that building that just got built, but they don't realize that's not just limit. That's not size, just that's one part of size up. There's so much more that goes into it. And it's actually up to everyone too, right? Oh, that's the officer's job. I don't think it's the officer's job alone. Do you, Chief?
No, sir, not at all. You know, when I was on companies, especially here in Durham, and but even more so in my volunteer department, you know, we're ready to make that decision. We're going to make a fire attack or whatever it is we're going to do, that tactic we're going to perform on the fire ground. Hey, this is what I saw. This is what I'm thinking. Is everybody good? Did I miss something? You know, and that's where that whole team piece comes in. And again, you're right. Size up is for everyone. And whether you're a junior on the department or whether you're somebody with 50 or 60 years on a department, you size up things, and each individual sees things a little bit differently. And we have to take that information, process it so that we can make that good decision so that we're doing what's best for our citizens, their property, and then what's best for us ultimately as firefighters too.
When you get into this, when you do get into the size up on the fire ground, you describe a couple of absolutes that really got to be immediately identified and recognized and possibly worked into your SOP, SOGs. You have absolutes are like victims, basement fire type construction. Can you
Right.
talk, what are your absolutes that absolutely as the incident commander, you want someone to tell you about, or you yourself are looking for when you're doing a, let's say, a 360.
So, you know, so a little bit about the 360 is that, you know, the 360, obviously, we want to try and get done if we can. Sometimes you're going to go to homes, to residences. You're not going to be able to get around. If you can just get you a look at the backside of the building, just so that you're not missing anything. And when I say missing something, I'm specifically thinking in reference to a basement, Chief. Because a lot of times the fire's in the basement, firefighters miss it, and you know, we've had some firefighters through the years get hurt and unfortunately have died from basement fires. And so for me, that's one of the key absolutes is the presence of a basement. I need to know if it's there. And sometimes that that rear view, that Charlie side view will give you that. But even furthermore, you can have, it just depends on the layout of the building, depends on where you are. There are a lot of things that can be different from the front side to the rear. And the big thing is just the change in elevation of the number of spaces that you might be dealing with. So that's an absolute. And then, the next big absolute for me is just, do I have a visible victim that I've got to address, right? If that's the case, I want to address them immediately, and go from there. From there, I like to know where the fire is, and not just necessarily where it's located, but where might it be heading to? Again, understanding building construction, taking a good read of the building. And I'm of the opinion that slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And I'm all about moving with purpose on the fire ground, because I believe that's what we as firefighters should do, is move with purpose. But don't move so quickly that you miss stuff. And I think that if we were all being true to ourselves, we could all probably think about fires that we've been to where we did conduct that initial size up, and maybe we missed something that we look back on and like, I missed that. Maybe I shouldn't have missed that to begin with. Conversely, I can also speak to a fire in my volunteer area where ranch style house from the front, everything looked, it was smoke showing, but it was a ranch style view from the front. When you got to the Charlie side, it had a walkout basement. And that's where the fire was. But the unfortunate thing about that was that the basement wasn't found until after the mutual aid department got there. And those absolutes are what you want to find early on in the incident, not deeper in the incident, not when things are not going well. You want to find that early on so that you can address it and handle it correctly. So, when I start talking about those types of things, I want to address them. In North Carolina, we have LP gas. And typically what we're seeing now in a lot of our places is that these 100-pound gas cylinders, they'll set them up against the house for gas logs, that kind of stuff. And, those have been problematic for us. And the big thing there is that if you can you shut the flow down, make sure the tank's off, can you get it away from the house? Because a 100-pound cylinder is small enough that firefighters can move. And those are the things that if I'm an incident commander too, that I want to know about. So when I start thinking about all these things, that's the information that I've got to process, and maybe some hazards that I got to mitigate and deal with. And again, the earlier I can know about it, the better. Sometimes some verbal communication over the radio goes a long ways. Hey, chief, so one story, 1500 square foot, it's on a slab. That right there tells me I don't have to worry about a basement,
Right.
Or better yet, they come back and say, chief, it's one story. My lap, I found a basement in the rear, that kind of stuff. And those are the things that I think are absolutes that we really have to get. The earlier in the incident, the better.
Yeah, and you point out in the article too, then once you do a good size up, once you properly size up the incident and gather the important information, the officer in charge then makes an informed decision based on the risk that's been identified. And you even say many times the incident commander might have limited information from an inadequate or incomplete size up, and that can lead to problems, possibly like, I don't know if that's what happened with that basement fire you were talking about, but that size up did not find the basement until much later in the incident. And that could have really posed a risk to those firefighters.
Certainly. Yeah. And so that's the thing. I mean, when we talk about decision-making, and I'm no authority on decision-making by no means, but to make the best decision, I got to have as much information as I can. And, again, that comes from that, just making sure that I do what I need to do when I arrive on the fire ground, that officer does what they're supposed to do. And, like I said, you may not be able to get around the building or the house, but try and get your eyes on the back of it just to help you identify what you're dealing with.
Right. Right. And that's size up begins before the incident. Size up is for everybody. Pay attention to what's going on in your area. Pay attention to your staffing. Pay attention to your weather conditions, whatever it is. And then it continues once you do get on the emergency scene. And then it ties together with your established SOPs and SOGs. And you can go from there. And you point out, too, that in your opinion, arguably one of the most important aspects at any emergency scene is command and control. And I bet it's all our listeners can think to themselves that they've seen good command and control, and they've all probably seen bad command and control. How can we get better at that? We talked just a minute ago about, the incident commander working the pump, and that kind of plays into, you might have to do that, but you still got to maintain command and control on that scene. So what are some of your tips for the listeners about having good command and good control at the emergency scene, and how can that help mitigate risk identified in these NIOSH 5?
So I think that, I think a couple of things. One, you have to have an understanding of what is my responsibility, number one, as an incident commander. I think you have to understand the gravity of that responsibility, because it's not something that you should take lightly. The other piece of it is that, obviously there's got to be some training in place, and that's the hard thing for me, especially on the volunteer side, is that, again, speaking from my organization, there's the incident management system, or NIMS is what we call it here in North Carolina, that we do, and we learn about large scale incidents, how to manage it, the different, all the different components that go along with it. But I think that you've got to be able to correlate how does that work out with my single family dwelling that's on fire? How do I bring some of those components in that help me manage this incident effectively? How do I do that? And that's where that training piece comes in. And a lot of times, we just don't simply offer the fire ground training, that level, that fire ground commander level training, within our departments. And that's one of the things that I'll speak to about FDIC that has been really beneficial for my career, is that, I've been able to sit in some classes with some folks that are just phenomenal incident commanders, and it's taught me a lot. Furthermore on that, I've had some good mentors too that were really strong command chiefs, and I watched and learned from them. I mean, that was a lot of my training is, okay, how are they managing the incident? What is their posture on the fire ground? What their radio traffic, all that kind of stuff. And so I think it's not just a one solution thing. I think being a good commander is something that you evolve into. I think it starts with some fundamental leadership skills, some fundamental manager, being a manager type skills. But then you also have to have a good understanding of what command is, and then how to command and how to bring all the components together, because some of these incidents can expand, right? As much as they, it may not be that single family dwelling. It might be that you've got a townhouse in your area, and that it's working from townhouse to townhouse, or even a strip mall that's going from business to business. So the thing that I would really encourage people to do is, we always talk about that centralized command, but don't be afraid to assign divisions. One of the things that I think we do well here in Durham is that we put somebody on the Charlie side to coordinate and operate the Charlie side. And what that does is gives a set of eyes for the incident commander at the rear of the building. But the other piece that it does is that it takes away some of that radio traffic for the operation that might be going on the Charlie side. But even more important is on the interior, when you've got that one person that's in charge on the interior directing things. Again, what it does is I think it helps calm the communications. It allows you to be within that span of control and can direct things a little more efficiently. But again, that's a difficult thing if you're if you're limited on personnel, you know, which I'm not sure of a fire department in America today that's not limited in some capacity in their staffing. So I think that I said a lot of things to say this, Chief, that it's an understanding piece, it's some training. I think it's an evolution of the individual as they grow in the fire service, because our good commanders just don't, they just didn't step into the organization green off the street. It was something learned.
Yeah. You know, Dave McGrail said it great in your, you know, you quote Dave McGrail, the great chief out of Denver. You know, a strong and experienced incident commander is the single most important component to a safe and successful fire ground operation. And I think it's important for all of us to understand, like you just said, it's an evolving process to become good at command and control. And it amazes me the times that I see firefighters or officers who make it into the chief ranks and stop training. It's easy to get consumed doing other things, but my gosh, your training never stops, no matter how far up the chain you go. And yeah, you talked about management. You know, you've got to develop people skills. And of course, you've got to develop that command and control of emergency incident skill as well. And if the emergency incident escalates, nothing really prepares you other than experience, than training. And like you said, you get great training at FDIC for it. Take advantage of those opportunities and understand that training never stops. It might change a little bit as you go through the ranks, but it never stops. You don't get the white helmet, or maybe it's a red helmet of a truck company lieutenant or an engine lieutenant, and say, I get a pass on training now. Absolutely not. You've got to train.
And you say that louder for the folks in the back of the room. I think that is one of the areas of the fire service that I battle with the most, especially now that I'm at the level I'm at as a battalion chief, is that, you know, it's so easy to get consumed in the administrative side of a chief's job, whether it's a volunteer chief or whether it's a chief on a career department. It's so easy to get consumed in the business side of things. But when you lose touch of what it is that firefighter has to do on the fire ground, I think that truly affects your ability to command the incident. If you don't understand that, if you forget the challenges that firefighter faces, and you don't understand what's going on the inside of the environment because you've not continued your training and maintained your training, that's, you set yourself up for failure. And that's, you know, that's one of the big reasons why I still go to conferences and try and get out as much as I do, is because, you know, at the battalion chief level, I don't want to lose touch with the job. It doesn't matter what color my helmet is, Chief. At the end of the day, I'm a firefighter, and that's what I am. And, you know, just because I'm a chief doesn't mean that I might not need to stretch a line at some incident, or maybe even force a door, or, you know, you just don't ever know what the situation will present itself or how it will present itself. I've got to be just as prepared as I expect my firefighters to be. And then if I'm going to lead by example, I've got to get in there and train with them too. Mm-hmm. And if I'm training with them, that's going to bring a level of confidence to the fire ground. And that whole command and control piece plays into that, because now they know, okay, the chief is trained with us. We have confidence in him. If he's telling us to back out, we know that he's making the right call, so forth, so on. So just because I've made it to this level, it's even more important now that I train, because I get so inundated with so many other duties that sometimes those basic firefighting skills get pushed to the side, and they should not. They should,
right,
they should.
Right. You know, I tell a story all the time. I used to, when I was a chief, I used to tell this to my young officers about command and control, and I'll sum it up in one sentence, and I take it from the movie Midway, and I'm probably going to get the characters wrong, but I believe it was Bo Halsey who was tied up in the hospital and couldn't go out. So they appointed a junior officer to fill in for him. And the junior officer, it might have been Race Brunitz, I'm not sure, but he came in and said, "Are you crazy giving me this command?" And he looked at him and said, "Just remember one thing: when in command, command." I love that line, and it sums it up so eloquently about, you know, don't play it how you think I would play it. You play it how you think you should play it. And when in command, command. Be confident in your ability, and right, and take strong ownership of the scene, and you run that scene. And you know, just because you have all the skills to be a great firefighter or whatever got you to the position you're in, maybe you're a good test taker, whatever it is, you still got to train for that on-scene command and control. And you really talk about that in the article so well.
Can I add one thing to that?
Absolutely.
You're right. Command the incident. And I think, I'm not exactly sure what the thought process is with some chiefs out there, but they kind of take that approach that, you know, yeah, I'm in command. I'm visible. I'm out here. I'm present, but you don't hear a lot of direction on the radio, or you just don't feel the command presence. Right. And when you're in command and you're commanding like you should, the other piece of it is that you have to understand the responsibility that you have to those people, to those firefighters that are operating. And it's all about business, and you got to have some thick skin. You got to be willing to make those tough decisions. And it's not something that, you know, you should take very lightly. So when we start talking about I think Chief Goldfeder said it one time, be a dictator on the fire ground. And that can be a difficult word for some folks, but at the end of the day, what he's saying is exactly what you just said. Command the incident, be that incident commander. You're going to have to make tough decisions. You're going to have to do things that your firefighters don't like, but at the end of the day, that's what the job requires. You've got to be willing to do what the job of the incident commander requires.
And one of the things you say in the article is you are leading people into battle. You really are. You know, that's this isn't a kid's game, and you got to be prepared for that. What are your thoughts on who establishes command? I know some companies wait for the first chief to get there, but you don't buy into that. I don't either. Why don't you? What are your thoughts with who establishes command?
So I'm a big believer of the first arriving officer being in command. And usually, let me separate here a little bit. For my career department, that's pretty easy, right? Because we're arriving with an engine company or a ladder company, and there's a group of people there as a dedicated officer. And I want that officer to go ahead and take command. I want some control of that fire ground, because firefighters, we're gonna push that envelope, if you will, because we want to do the job. And sometimes freelancing starts to creep in, I feel like, if there's not that initial command and control. The harder part, though, on the volunteer side is that sometimes it may be that new person that actually gets there first, because they may respond POV, personal vehicle, right? So it really becomes, for me, then that first officer. They can start sizing up, giving information, but I really want the officer to be in command. And the reason for that is just because I'm looking at that officer that has a little bit more experience, a little more knowledge, that kind of stuff, and understands the responsibility that they've been charged with when they're in command of other firefighters. And sometimes on a volunteer fire ground that happens, and sometimes it doesn't. But you know, if you're in a system where a lot of times that you're a firefighter and you end up being in command, understand what that task is about. As far as on my career side, my organization is kind of, if the chief is a ways out, they want you to go ahead and establish it and then pass to the chief when the chief arrives. and we do that, but I'm a big believer in that first arriving officer, establish command, give direction to the fire ground, give direction to other personnel and units that are coming in. Go ahead and start coordinating things, because you, as the first new officer, you understand the build. You have that initial intimate knowledge of what you're dealing with, and you're the one that can give the good direction.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think it helps eliminate that freelancing piece. Not that I want good, aggressive firefighters that want to go to work. I want the firefighters that are going to push that envelope of freelancing rather than those that like to hide out and not do the work on the fire ground. But I like having that control. And it's, some people would argue that, but I think it's a safety element as much as anything, Chief.
Sometimes you read about, this can be controversial. I've been in several classes. I think Chief Salk has talked about this quite a bit. Commanding from inside. You're a young company officer. You know the chief is on the way, or a senior officer. Following your plan there, you're the incident commander on scene because the chief isn't there yet, or the senior officer. Can you go in with your crew and still be the incident commander? And his class and his philosophy is you definitely can be. You know, you can maintain command and control of the scene while you're leading that initial crew in to fight the fire.
And to that end, you know, when I first started in the fire service, specifically here in Durham, that's kind of how it was. You know, I can remember my first officer, numerous calls, you know, engine two A's got command, and it's going to be mobile command. You know, I've got stuff I've got to do, but I've got command and in charge. And, you know, he had a command presence about him, even in that aspect of the incident. I mean, yeah, he's mobile, he's moving around, he's doing things, but there was still a command presence there. So, yeah. That's just what I prefer. And again, I don't necessarily think there's a definitive right and wrong. I think the incident drives it. I think your staffing, your resources, I think there are a lot of elements that play in. What's the culture of your organization even plays in. But at the end of the day, I just think about that scene safety, making sure that the strategy is being supported by the right tactics and that kind of stuff. And because I think it helps when that chief does arrive, I think it already has things in motion for him that helps him. So.
And as you say so good in the article too, another line I love that you put in there, you know, if you're a strong incident commander, if you've got good command and control, don't let complacency, arrogance, or ego get the best of you. It's a team effort. Yes, you're the leader, but folks, it's a team effort. So here's even where size up again comes into it. If you're getting information from some of your team players, you know, use it. Don't discount it.
That's correct. Yes, sir. 100%. You know, and a lot of times, you know, commanders, I'll just say this, my better commanders, they understood the aspects of what their job was, of what the fire ground was, and they, you know, complacency was never an issue, nor was arrogance or ego. And again, they were very direct. They were very, you know, this is what was going to get accomplished and you were going to do this. And you rolled with it, you know, and again, sometimes I hope we're not losing that as a service.
Right. Right. I just want to take 1 second, Chief, and remind the listeners that they're listening to Fire Engineering Talk Radio and the installment of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. And joining me on this episode is Chief Richard Ray, who's a captain in the Creedmoor Volunteer Fire Department in North Carolina. And he's got 30 years of experience in the fire service. He's also a battalion chief in Durham, North Carolina. And what we are talking about on this episode is the four key elements of the fire ground, four key elements that can help achieve greater success on the fire ground. And I know, Chief, you've got a busy day, and we've covered two of the elements, including size up and command and control. But I want to get into resources real quick and fire ground coordination. And what should we know about having the proper resources available? How can understanding your resources contribute to fireground success, or maybe take away from any success because we don't have them?
Well, again, that goes back to, you have to look at, you've got to take an honest look at your organization, right? And when we start talking about resources, I generally lump resources into one of two categories: personnel and then equipment. And so, you know, I mentioned in the article, you know, when I first started in the fire service, if a mutual aid department called us, they wanted water. There was limited water supply, and they wanted us to bring our big truck and give them water. Now that's changed. Now it's become personnel, you know, that departments now are really struggling. So the mutual aid piece is more from a personnel standpoint, because now that, as the fire service has evolved, fire departments are buying bigger engines, putting more water on it, more equipment on it. So the equipment piece is not as much of a challenge as maybe what it used to be. The thing that I would say about resources is though you have to look at how your department responds. You've got to be honest with yourself. Am I putting 6, 8, 10, 12 firefighters on the fire ground, or am I putting 20 on the fire ground? What can I do? What resources do I need coming from another agency? Where are my shortfalls? So, for example, if you have an area in your response area that requires a ladder truck, and you don't have one, well, we need to get that mutual aid agreement in place so we can have the appropriate resource responding. One of the things that I would also encourage listeners about their resources and their equipment, that kind of stuff, is, how proficient are you with your equipment? How efficient and effective is your equipment? So, for example, you know, there's a lot out now about attack packages and that kind of stuff, and that the work that's being done is really, really good. But what I would say is that, you know, not all fire departments have budgets where they can go out and buy new hose and nozzles. Well, how do you maximize that resource, because your attack package is a resource for mitigating the fire scene, right? So how do you learn to maximize your equipment so that it provides you with the most efficient, effective service for the citizen? So when I start talking about equipment, I start thinking about that way. You know, what are you doing to your ladders? Do you have the balance points marked? Do you have some saws that can help you get the job done? And anything that you're neglecting, if you have a mutual aid department that has it, have them coming. And to that end, in the middle of the day, in my area, in my volunteer area, we get a structure fire call. Again, it may be 3 or 4 people there. So what other resources am I going to need to help, to supplement my short staffing? And again, a lot of the resource piece can be done on the front end of the incident. And that's one of the things that I like about that aspect, is that that's something that we can do as firefighters on the front end to help us do our job. And, so again, for me, resources, I kind of view it as a two-part piece: personnel and equipment. And I think you really have to take an honest look at your organization, evaluate what you have, what are you trying to accomplish? What do you need to do? Or has ISO come in and said, okay, we've done your inspection, this is your grade, but these are the recommendations that we have for you. This is what you need to be doing different. So yeah, I look at that aspect of it too.
You know, I think in my area too, I've definitely noticed when I first joined, mutual aid was mainly for extra vehicles, where today it definitely is for additional personnel. Definitely happening in our area. Matter of fact, several times this week, my department was alerted to go automatic aid for structure fire assignments in nearby jurisdictions. It's worked out really well. I think with resources, I jotted down the way I look at it. I have 3 bullet points with resources: understand what you have, train on what you have, so you certainly know how it all works, and plan for what you don't have and what you may need.
Absolutely, yes.
And that includes with your mutual aid partners. Get to know them, get to work with them, get to know each other. And the professional thing to do, and I've talked about it many times on this show, is to establish working relationships with your neighbors. And if there's a problem or something happened 40, 50 years ago, which we know happens in the fire service, bury the hatchet, for lack of a better term, probably not a correct term to use today. I don't know. Extend the olive branch, sit down and have a coffee, work with them, because the resident in need, your residents, don't want to hear anything about what might have happened 10, 20, 30, or in some cases, 50 years ago with your great grandparents, you know, and the great grandparents of another department. No, no, that's not the professional thing to do. Work together. So understand the resources you have available, train on the resources that you have, and plan for what you might not have.
And what I would say to that end too, Chief, you're right. If we have some kind of turf war going on or some kind of ego issue between fire departments, there's only one set of people that affects, and that's the citizen.
Right.
And the citizen doesn't care whose name is on the side of that truck, by and large, or on the back of the jacket or on the front of the helmet. They want a trained professional firefighter to help take care of their business or what their issue is, because we're going to see them on their worst day of their life. And I'm a firm believer too, that you talk about training and working together. That's how we get rid of that drama and that ego, is that we bring people together, work together as a team. And then you start to understand capabilities, and just in understanding capabilities alone, be it individual, be it departmental, that can help you formulate how you're going to mitigate an incident when it happens.
Mm-hmm. And make that incident safer for everybody.
That's right.
So what do you mean by coordination, fire ground coordination? How does that play into making the scene more successful or the outcome more successful?
So you know, I think about, obviously, everything that we do on the fire ground goes to support life safety and property conservation. And when I start talking about coordinating the fire ground, you know, when you look up the word coordination, what does it mean? I think it means, what my perception of what it means and yours might be two different things. And I think that's where a little bit of an issue of coordination comes in. But when I'm talking about coordination, I'm talking about things working together on the fire ground, and it benefits the citizen, and it benefits us, the firefighters. So part of that coordination is that I've got a fire attack going on, and I've got a search going on simultaneously, and they're working together. Or I'm coordinating my ventilation with my fire attack so that I don't get ventilation ahead of water on the fire and cause that unwanted fire growth, or my ventilation on my search where, you know, I do the wrong ventilation and it affects my search team. So I try and, you know, I believe that coordination piece is where you bring things together and it works together on the fire ground for the greater good. The problem and coordination can also be the part of just doing tasks simultaneously. You know, the search, the ventilation, the attack, everybody's doing their job, but how are they working together to get the jobs accomplished? And so that's what I'm looking at. And for your FDNYs, your LA County, LA City, Chicago, for most of your larger municipal departments, and even here in Durham. I mean, it's that coordination piece is relatively easier to accomplish than it is on the volunteer side, because on the volunteer side, my staffing is going to be way more limited. So when I start talking about coordination on the volunteer side, it may not be that it's actually coordinated, but more that it's sequential, and I've got to do what the priority action at the time is. Is it picking that person out of a window with a ladder and maybe another driver or firefighter, somebody trying to address the fire? Whereas if I had that same situation in my career department, you know, I could assign ladder three to addressing the victim. You know, engine three's got the attack. Engine one's going to bring me my order. You know, I can lay it out a little bit differently. And that's the fire ground coordination that we want so that we can get a lot of things done at once. But the volunteer side of it, like we've said, is quite different, and you have to do things sequentially. So that's kind of where I went with it in the article, was that I was just really focusing on how do we achieve our incident priorities, and how do we coordinate those things together. But what happens when we don't have the people to do it? Because it takes people to get that coordination going.
It sure does.
And that's if you want to say what's the difficulty in fire ground coordination, is having the adequate number of personnel on scene to get the things going. So that's kind of what I looked at there. And then if you look a little bit deeper in the article, and it just talks about, you know, coordinating is not all, you know, I believe, let's see here, some volunteer departments are staffed well and coordinating the fire ground is not an issue. But in my volunteer department, again, we may not always have the staffing to get these things done.
Sounds to me like one thing that can help with coordination would be well written and well rehearsed or trained on SOPs, SOGs, or whatever, again, you want to call them, best practices, whatever. You had a couple points about what makes a good SOP, and I put in big bold print in my notes, and I actually wrote it down in one of the classes I was in at Utah. Was they got to work. You know, it's one thing to have SOPs, SOGs, but my gosh, they got to work, and we have to train on them. People need to understand. But I mean, I would think, right, Chief, if you have really well rehearsed SOPs and SOGs that work, it's got to really help fire ground coordination, because you get people off the rigs and they know what their initial actions are going to be.
That's right. Yes, sir. And I think that's a key component, you know. And here's the other piece that I would say about the SOGs. Not only do they work, but that's got to be a living document within your organization, because we can all agree at how much the fire service is changing daily. And you've got to stay on top of things. You can't just, you know, because that we, you know, we've proved through some of these UL studies and that kind of stuff that some of our tactics that we used to do, they might have worked back in the day, but now things are a little bit different and we have to address things differently. So make sure your SOGs, not just that they work, but make sure that they're up to date, that it's a living document.
You recommend that everybody read the study conducted by the Underwriters Laboratory, study of coordinated fire attack and acquired structures. I believe you think it would help what firefighters better understand this fire ground coordination, how important it is.
Yeah, yes, sir. Absolutely. I would really recommend that one, but I'd also like to add another one that was just recently released. And that is the search and rescue study that was done. Because that now incorporates fire attack, search, and there's some ventilation. We've got ventilation as well. So the three main things that we've got to get done on the fire ground right out the gate have been addressed and studied by UL. And I would recommend that, you know, definitely look at the coordinated fire attack, look at the search study, but also look at that ventilation study too, so that you can use those to help you get your SOGs. You can really tune your SOGs up by looking at those elements in those studies, because they're providing you with some solid facts and some tactical considerations that can really help your organization. So, you know, the thing about the coordinated fire attack study that I really like is that it talks about line placement. It talks about water placement, all that kind of stuff. And that's built off of another study that UL did, but it's really those studies, I think they would help a department tune their SOGs so that they can have that coordinated fire ground.
Very good. And again, you know, part of what makes a professional firefighter, again, put the paycheck aside, it's studying and learning and understanding what's going on in today's fire service and staying on top of the studies and trends and things like that. And I'm glad you pointed it out. So again, for our listeners, it's the study that was conducted by the Underwriters Laboratory, coordinated fire attack and acquired structures. And they just released one, the chief said, search and rescue study that was just released. And I imagine they're online. If people went online and just typed in underwriters and search and rescue or coordinated fire attack, they would pop up.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, there you have it. If anyone's interested in delving more into this great article, it was in the April fire engineering issue. Four key elements of the fire ground, four key elements that maybe could help achieve better fire ground success and hopefully prevent one of the NIOSH five from creeping into your department. The NIOSH five, which identify five key contributing factors to firefighter fatalities. Again, the NIOSH five: inadequate risk assessment, poor communication, inadequate command, lack of accountability, and the lack of standard operating guidelines or procedures and the failure to follow them. And as Chief Ray says, if we identify these four key elements and how they can affect the NIOSH 5, how they can play into the NIOSH 5, proper size up, proper command and control, understanding our resources, and coordinating the fire ground in a more fluid manner, it can help maybe prevent those from creeping into our organizations. Chief, I really want to thank you for coming on and spending some time with us. I know you're extremely busy, but I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with me and my listeners today.
Thank you so much, Chief, for having me. It's always a pleasure. I love doing it. If I can, again, I look forward to chatting and talking shop again with you soon. And, hopefully I get to see you at FDIC, and
we'll count on it.
I just appreciate this opportunity. It's just love what you're doing for the volunteer service, and love what you're doing, for fire engineering as well. So thank you.
Absolutely. And, I want to just let the listeners know too, that you share, in this professional message. And I have a snapshot of a slide I took and one of your classes where you actually talk about professionalism. And for our listeners, Chief Ray has it. Professionalism, it doesn't matter if you're a career volunteer, the job of firefighting requires us to be professional. It's professional in our attitude, our skill, our desire, our training, and our equipment. Citizens expect us to be able to handle their problem with knowledge, ability, and speed. Chief, that is awesome. Thank you for helping spread that message. And I love something else that I took a snapshot of. The character of a firefighter. You had it in your one slide. The character of a firefighter, a la Alan Brunicini, right? Be humble, be kind, be selfless, be grateful, be mentally tough, and be true and be the best you can be. So well said, Chief.
Thank you.
You're going to see those quotes. I got some quotes. I also like the one you said, where slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Chief, you gave me several new posts for my social media sites. I appreciate that. Of course, I will fully credit you with those quotes that I'm going to borrow, but thank you so much. And if any of the listeners, Chief, wanted to get a hold of you to talk more about the four key elements of the fire ground or winning on the fire ground, or if they have volunteer or even career issues to talk to you about, what's the best way they can get a hold of you?
So I can, I'm on the social media. I'm on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram. You can also reach me at an email. My email is richard.ray74@gmail.com. You can look me up that way. But probably the easiest thing to do is probably just go out there on social media, search my name, shoot me a message, and we can talk shop that way. And I just appreciate this opportunity, Chief.
Absolutely. My pleasure to have you on. And if any of the listeners get a chance to see the Chief at FDIC, make sure you take in his class, or if he's in your area, don't hesitate to make sure that you get over to it to see him speak. And again, the April fire engineering issue has his article, Four Key Elements of the Fire Ground. And that's what our discussion here was about for the last hour. So I want to thank everybody for spending some time with us. If anybody wants to reach out to me, please check out my social media platforms, Facebook, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, Twitter, Instagram, my website, theprofessionalvfd.com. has all the listings of where I'm going to be and what I'm going to be up to, and a lot of links to podcasts and articles and things like that. So please check it out. And remember, it's not too early to start making plans to attend FDIC, the greatest firefighting conference in the world, next year in Indianapolis again, April 24th to the 29th. And would love to see you there. And again, thanks to Fire Engineering, my fire engineering family, Chief Bobby Halton, Clarion Events, for supporting all the podcasts, of course, mine, but all the other great podcasts. I'm just so honored that you choose to listen into mine. And I just want to, again, reaffirm to all my listeners that I remain committed to all of you to continue to focus on topics of relevance and importance in our volunteer fire service. So thanks again for joining in live, or maybe you pre-recorded it to listen later. I just want you to know I really do appreciate it. My next show will be October 18th. And again, we'll be talking about topics of importance concerning the volunteer fire service world. So thank you for tuning in. Please stay safe. And folks, remember, true professionalism is not defined by a paycheck. And your residents are owed professional service delivered by professional firefighters representing a professional organization. Thank you very much.